Welcome to The Happy Brain, the podcast that answers your questions about the happy brain chemicals, dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphin. Hi, I'm Loretta Bruning, founder of the Inner Mammal Institute and author of Habits of a Happy Brain, Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. I hope you enjoy our show today. And if it raises any questions in your mind, feel free to send them to me, either through the contact form at the Inner Mammal Institute, which is innermammalinstitute.org, or contact me on Facebook, and you're invited to enjoy our Facebook discussion group with the Inner Mammal Institute, or my daily Facebook message on Loretta Bruning PhD page. Now, enjoy the show. Hi, everyone. I'm here today with Dennis Harhalarkis, who's an expert in money behavior and money psychology. So we're going to talk about money. So he's the founder of Cambridge Money Coaching, and he teaches people to understand their patterns and behaviors around money so they can develop more positive financial behaviors. So I know that money worries are universal and it's easy to blame the economy, but positive financial behaviors, I think, are so valuable. So I'm really looking forward to hearing more about it. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Loretta. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. So glad to have you.
Thank you.
So to start off, do you have any questions for me?
Yeah, I'm always curious about the happy chemicals, and I was wondering why, is some people seem to pursue one or more of them, and some people like to pursue dopamine, and some people like serotonin, and I wondered whether that's, in your experience, people had different mixes, or is it just is a random thing?
I think it's random that's learned from early experience. So we all learn from what works. So one person, when they were young, they may have had fabulous dopamine experiences, and another person may have had fabulous oxytocin or serotonin experiences. So that's why we have tendencies. We're inclined to go what works, but maybe a wide variety. You know, you may have pros and cons in each of the chemicals, and you may have two chemicals that you favor and two that you don't favor or something. But the bottom line is that we're not fundamentally different, and therefore, instead of saying I'm a this type and therefore I should focus on this, in my opinion, if I'm ignoring one of the chemicals, then I will get more benefit from just a little bit of that than repeating the thing I'm already used to. That's my opinion.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
So you said you had another question?
Yeah. The other question was, I'm curious about the difference between the anxiety caused by a dip in a happy chemical versus the anxiety caused by a spike in cortisol.
Great, great question. So a dip in a happy chemical is not anxiety unless you learn that, because it's the closest thing. If you think of a teenager who says, I'm bored. Bored is a really good word for a dip in a happy chemical, because a happy chemical tells you, this is where you should focus your attention. This is going to be good. This is it. And when you're bored, you don't see anything that says, this is it, this is it. And like you're waiting for this is it. So when I call that neutral. It's clearing the decks to be having your energy available to invest in the next thing. And is that good or bad? Well, one person learns that it's bad because once they have nothing going on, they don't know how to make something going on. Whereas another person, like, let's say, for example, I spend a year working on a book. Then a lot of people, when you spend a year focused on a big goal, then as soon as the big goal is over, people tend to feel down. But if you could say, wow, I have to give up other things in order to work on this project. So instead of being depressed when the project is over, I'm looking forward to picking up all the things that I had to put aside in the past few months. So that's a positive way of thinking about it, but it takes some mental discipline to do that. And cortisol, it's just that already feels like a threat, and it just takes mental discipline to not get into a threat spiral.
Okay, thanks.
Great. Well, so I see that you talk to people about money fears, money conflicts with family members, and money habits. So there's so much here that's so fascinating. And the first thing I'd like to ask you is the get rich quick mindset. So I run into people with this get rich quick mindset. And let's say someone came to you for coaching and they didn't even know they had it, but when they told you what they were doing, you could tell that that's where they were going. What would you tell them?
Right. Yeah, good question. So with the money coaching framework that we use, we have 8 money archetypes that we work with, and all of us have those money archetypes within ourselves. So essentially they are archetypes of representations of subconscious behaviors. So I think, you know, you're familiar with the chimp. The chimp is an archetype.
Okay.
So within money coaching, we use 8 different ones. And the one that you're referring to is probably called the fool.
By the way, are these archetypes, are they in a book that's or a blog post or something somewhere?
Yeah, that's correct. So if you go into the Money Coaching Institute website, the Money Coaching Institute in California, or in Deborah Price's book, Money Magic, they're all in there. There's 8 of them.
Okay.
And we have some of each of them in us. So people that are that you're talking about get rich quick, they would have a high fool archetype.
So if someone came into your office and had a get rich quick attitude and you told them they were a fool, they might not take too well to that. How would you present it to them?
Of course. So what I would ask them to do is I'd ask them to take the money type quiz. And the money type quiz is a way of ascertaining, essentially bringing out your subconscious behavior. And then I would say, do any of the following type of activities seem familiar with you? You know, are you impetuous? Are you financially irresponsible? Are you overindulgent? Are you careless or reckless? You know, and are these things that you wish to improve? Some people are quite happy like that, but it's actually not a very positive way to live, because you, you move from feast to famine. A lot. You have a lot of fear of missing out, and if you're living with a person, if you're in a relationship with a fool, and you don't share that fool type behavior, that is very, very challenging.
Although two fools together is even more challenging. Right?
Two fools together aren't great, but at least they don't clash continuously. If I showed you one of the other archetypes, which is, say, the innocent. And the innocent is fearful or anxious, indecisive. And the innocent's goal is safety at all costs.
Oh, what is the chimp? I'd love to know what the chimp is.
Well, the chimp is just, what I meant by the chimp was, the chimp is just simply an example of an archetype
that is
more familiar to maybe your readers or listeners. It's like, everyone's heard of the chimp, the inner chimp. The chimp is just simply an archetype.
But it's not a money archetype.
No. The money archetypes are innocent, victim, warrior, martyr, fool, creator artist, tyrant, and magician. And so we have 3 positive ones. They are the magician, the creator artist, and the warrior. And the others are all negative, or they have negative, sides to them. And so when in money coaching, we say, who's driving the car? And we want the warrior to drive the car, because the warrior is the archetype of action. We want the magician to be with the warrior, because the magician has vision and spirituality. And we want the creator artist to be in the car as well, because the creator artist has an artistic side.
Okay. Please repeat this. What was the second one again?
That you just
said, of the 3 positive ones.
So the 3 positive ones are the warrior, the magician, and the creator artist.
Oh, okay. Good.
And so all the others, if you think of like, who's making the money decisions in your life? Mm. You want to be the warrior. You want, you know, that you want the warrior driving the car. We the victim, the martyr, the innocent, and the tyrant, we keep them in the boot of the car.
But what if the warrior is a gorilla and like the movie the book Death of a Salesman or something, that they pressure themselves to the point of constant stress, then what would you tell them?
Right. So that's not a warrior, that's a tyrant.
Oh.
So we have three good behaviors, but when they go bad, they move into tyrant. So warrior is powerful, driven, loyal.
Okay, like and there's a phrase, a happy warrior. So
that's right. So what happens is we have all of these within us. And when we're under stressful situations, some of the less attractive archetypes can pop up. So for example, people who are normally warriors, when they're severely financially stressed, they can morph into tyrants. And the tyrant is a strong warrior, but they use money to control people.
Or they could also become a victim. I think in Death of a Salesman, he was more like a victim.
That's right. So his victim plays up. So when there's stress or adverse circumstances, the lower archetypes, you know, it's almost like saying somebody's worst side comes to the fore. So that's how we think of that.
Mm. You mentioned feast or famine thinking, and I want to tell an interesting story about that, and then I'd love to hear your stories. So I did not grow up in that mindset. So, you know, we all have our, you know, like everyone thinks the pain they grew up with was so serious, but then when you hear like other people's pain, you're like, wow. So somebody who grew up in this feast or famine thing, I never realized, like, they were poor, but the minute they got money, they would just spend it all immediately. Mm. And this, like, I'm going to go buy a boat. And she was saying how that's what her father did. And her parents fought over it. And she sympathized with her father. And so then she ended up doing that. And then she was always too broke to pay her bills. And she literally did not associate it with the fact that she bought a boat when she had the money.
Sure.
And then that's one side. But another side of this, when you say not have money to pay the bills, I knew someone whose mother had she was much more educated than my family and had more money, but she literally didn't pay the electric bills, and the electricity literally went off in their family. And this woman I knew grew up sort of having to grab the electric bill from her mother and pay it just because her mother was so flaky. Any examples you have of the feast or famine mindset?
Well, I just like to say that those what's coming through very strongly here is that how challenging those environments are for children to grow up in.
Yes.
And so what you're seeing there is a direct connection between the subconscious money messages that the children are receiving and their own behavior. And in general, as a child, you'll tend to follow the behavior that you've it's your subconscious inheritance, really. You'll tend to follow. You might say to yourself, well, when I'm a mum or a dad, I'm not going to be like that. But it's already hardwired into you. And then occasionally you'll find people that just go completely the opposite way, and they say, whatever happens, I'm going, and they make a subconscious pact with themselves. So typically, children who've grown up in severe deprivation and famine will be very, very careful with money, but they may also then flip into the fool archetype that says, I have no idea how much this is going to last. I'm going to spend it. It's here. It's now. I'm going to spend it. And so when a lot of the clients I work with internalize this and they go, they don't understand it, but when they internalize it, they think there's something wrong with themselves. And so you end up with this, and this is the thing with money that I find so fascinating and yet puzzling is that very few people get shown how to have a healthy relationship with money, and very few people get shown how to manage money properly. And so we end up with a situation where people feel guilty and shameful because they can't do something they were never shown how to do.
Okay. So could you give us a very short introduction to what you would consider a healthy financial behavior?
Yeah. The origins of this, at least as far as my personal journey actually came from a very interesting study done in the US. There was a gentleman who asked the simple question, why is it that you can give one person a salary and they'll save 20% of it, and you can give another person the same salary and they'll spend all of it and a lot more? What is it that is, you know, what are the common factors around people's behavior around money that mean that you know, produce such completely different outcomes? And this is so relevant today, because because our futures are so uncertain, that we need to be saving and investing early in life, as opposed to spending that money on you know, overdraft charges and credit card charges. So critical. Anyway, the research was done by a guy called Dr. Falau, and he wrote a book on it called The Millionaire Next Door. And he identified four positive financial behaviors. And this was common to people that had managed to build wealth over their lifetimes. And he put it down to four things. One of them, the first one, is frugality, because essentially you need to spend less than you earn, and in order to save some money. This is obviously core. Right? It sounds simple, and it's really hard for some people to do because they've never been shown how to.
Well, and it's even used as an insult sometime when you call someone frugal.
So here's a really interesting point about this. And if you look at the language around money, we have two words. We have spender or saver. Mm-hmm. Right. We don't have a happy bit in the middle. Mm-hmm. We put people into those two buckets. And if you look at those two buckets, people that can't spend, this is where the extreme behaviors are, because mm-hmm. people that can't control their spending, or people that can't spend because they're too frugal, like your example of the woman who couldn't bring herself to pay the phone bill. This is where the extremes are. So when you refer to positive financial behaviors, that is about saving money to buy things and then buying them. So that is a positive financial behavior, and it starts with frugality. But as you say, you know, there's a negative connotation about frugality, which is really unwarranted. And it clashes with this whole consumer society ethic or ethos that surrounds us, from messaging everything that will be solved if you just buy this, it'll make you happy, or if you buy this and invest in this, it'll make you happy. Let's put that to one side.
Okay.
We'll go for the other three and we can come back to this. So the second one is confidence. Confidence basically means understanding how things work. So that means it's basically can be thought of as financial literacy. It's about developing a certain, you know, understanding and knowledge around the financial system, understand how credit card work, understand how your bank account works, understand the basics of investing in an employer pension scheme. And so, you know, take some responsibility for learning a little bit about how to do this stuff. And there's so much on the internet available to you. It's really straightforward. And where most people fall down, they don't spend any time on it.
Yes.
So the stats in the UK are is that the average person in the UK, and it's the same in the US, spends 3 hours a day watching TV and 30 seconds a day on their finances. So, you know, if you put that over a month, you're spending half an hour on your finances a month, and whatever that number is, like 300 hours watching TV. And as you know, if you want to get good at something, you need to spend a bit of time, invest a bit of time in it. So that's the second one, that's confidence. Responsibility is the third one, and this is really key. Responsibility is saying, I take responsibility for my financial future. I take responsibility for my outcomes. I think the term is the locus of control is internal.
Yes.
And if you don't think that, you think that it's the system or that's just how life is, then it's very, very hard to drive outcomes in that situation. And we have an archetype, and that one's called the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth one is broadly termed social indifference. And social indifference is about not feeling that you need to buy or wear or have any of the things that people tell you you should have to be happy. You need to be comfortable with your choices. Now, mm-hmm. when you look at those four things, and those four things are essentially the positive financial behaviors that allow us to build wealth and to have money, allows us to save. It allows us to build nest eggs, retirement funds. It allows us to build what's really important right now is to have an emergency fund set away for just, occasions like now when the whole world shuts down.
So can I ask you the
behaviors that drive those. Carry on.
Let's say a person has pretty much good skills in this area and yet can't stop worrying. What would you tell them?
I would need to go one layer below. So positive financial behaviors are built on positive emotions and behaviors around money. And I would need to go, what is it that from your childhood that you feel threatened by? What behaviors that did you grow up with where you never felt secure?
Yes, I exactly agree that it's never actually about the money. It's about the fears that are below the money. And
that's right.
Below whatever happened in your childhood is our awareness of our mortality. And for aging people like myself, a lot of people are having money fears, what I always say is people think either I'll run out of money before I die, or I'll die before I run out of money. And the idea that you're going to die is so painful that people eliminate that option. So then they focus on the worrying about, I'm going to live forever, but my money will run out, because it distracts them from what they're really worried about. So I think people need to get comfortable with their mortality in order to stop worrying about money. That's my opinion.
There's some really interesting research around happiness, which breaks happiness down into two things. One is happy in your life, which is essentially happy, positive emotions, happy emotions, and happy with your life, which essentially means you have a sense of purpose, you have a sense of direction, you have a plan, and you're happy with where you're going on over a long-term basis. And so a lot of us get distracted with the happy in your life piece. We're always looking for those dopamine hits, those serotonin hits, and those oxytocin hits. And we forget that we need, that's only just part of it. And as you probably more than anyone else know, that's never fulfilling because, you get the hit and it goes away. So you need to have a sub base of happy with your life.
And people with that long range focus, again, when you think about the future and you know where you're going, but you're also going to the grave. So it's still something that I think is a source of underlying anxiety. And if it's not just death, but it's when you get old, that you may have some unpleasant outcomes that you've seen in older people around you. And you think, well, if I had more money, that would protect me from that, which it may not, but that's the thought process, in my opinion, that it's just a distraction from other fears.
Yeah, I think you're right. So there's money, and then you've often talked about legacy. So legacy is another part to it. What I'd like to do then is just flip this into the money piece, which says, okay, financial well-being in its broadest sense is about understanding where your finances are on a daily basis. In other words, knowing where I am right now, happy in my life, you know, in control of my finances, and also having a longer term financial plan. So happy with your finance, the state of your finances today, but also where we are on the longer path. And so that's why positive financial behaviors are so important, because they help you to control where you are right now and say, yes, I've got money in the bank, I've got savings, and I've got a, you know, and I've got a plan. I know where I'm going. And that, if you have well-being in its fullest sense, will give you, will reduce your anxiety about running out of money in the future.
It also gives you dopamine, because when you have a plan, then you feel like you're moving towards something, and then you have dopamine even without a lot of money. And of course, you know, the other side, ironically, is if a person has some huge financial goal and then they reach it, then the dopamine wears out, because it's not the movement and the achievement and the quest anymore. And so that's why it's not the quantity that counts.
Well, that's right. There's this great story of, I think, was it John D. Rockefeller? And somebody said, how much is enough? And he went, oh, just a little bit more. When he was at that point, he was the richest man. Nelson Rockefeller, the richest man in the world. How much is enough, Nelson? He went, just a little bit more. So
I think you mean John D. Rockefeller.
John D. Rockefeller.
Yeah, Nelson was his grandson.
So, so money is interesting, because in your line of work, you the neurobiology that understands that underpins the positive emotions and behaviors around money is fascinating, because a lot of the time you talk about, you know, core security needs, and the thing that happens with money is that because money can meet our core security needs, money becomes a core security need. So if you think about how the mammalian brain behaves around core security needs, how it behaves when it gets threats to food, shelter, sex, security in its broadest sense, and you look at the responses that the brain produces, and then you go, actually, money is a core security need. You understand now the responses around money. Because when money is a core security need, it the mammalian brain's in charge, and how that works for you at the individual level, which is your dominant archetype or archetypes, is determined by the money messages you got in childhood.
Mm-hmm. So, if a person today were talking to their children about money, do you have any particular tips?
Oh, I do. I'm so glad you asked that question, because I do a talk on how to raise financially capable children. And so there are six steps to this, or six key things that are really important here. First of all, is to understand the messages that you are giving your children, predominantly the subconscious messages.
Yes. That's what I was going to say. It's the subconscious message that you're giving the kid is what counts. Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's, so when I do money coaching, I, you know, explain to people about how the way they behave influences their children. The children will pick up on this. Behavior is information when you're a child, isn't it? You're trying to form, understand patterns, you're trying to form rules.
Yes.
And so the way the adults behave individually, but also collectively, which means that if the people in your life are always fighting about money because they have different views on it, or there's not very much on it, or then money gets associated with guilt and conflict and anger and shame, then you will carry that through for the whole of your life. And so showing parents the way they behave, the way they act, is, and the way that their self-limiting beliefs and anxieties are passed on to their children is very, very important. So that one is about messaging. The second one, I think, is about building a work ethic. And so children need to understand about chores. They need to understand about what they need to do in a family, as part of a family. And they need to do things like taking the garbage out, or washing the dishes, or mowing the lawn. All these things are key parts of building a work ethic. And all the research coming out of the US on those longitudinal studies will tell you that building a work ethic drives long-term happiness and satisfaction. So that's number two. Number three is about modeling reflective thinking. So, for example, what's the process that that you as a family go through to buy a car or a microwave? Right. What does that look like? Do you just go, well, that one's got the biggest screen, well, just have that one? Or do you go through a process of comparing options, of research? You know, what is that? Mm-hmm. What does that look like? Mm. And there's a parallel to that, which is having discussions with children about, you know, what are different ways of looking at things. So, you know, you got $100 from your grandma, and you know, you want to spend that all on in-app, in a shield or something from some game, or, you know, how do you think grandma would feel about that? What if she gave you $500? So you try and have conversations that allow children to consider that there are alternatives. Mm. So the fourth one is financial literacy, and this is really key. So you need to give a child an allowance so that they can learn how to build positive financial behaviors. You need to show them they need to save some of it, and you need to let them understand about choices they make with money as a child, so that when they become adults, you're not trying to teach them about how to manage a budget in the summer holiday before they go off to university, because that doesn't work. And you'd be really surprised how many people don't give their children allowances because of their own money concerns. They worry that if they give kids money, they'll squander it. Mm. Which, now, there's a really interesting message in there, which you don't need to go into, but you can understand what I'm trying to say. Mm. So, and then the other thing that happens is that if they give a child, you know, so the idea here is the allowance represents spending that you would have done. So, for example, if you say, look, I'm not going to buy you sweets anymore. Here is $10 a week for you to go and make your own choices around sweets. I'm not going to buy them for you. You make your own choices. And then the child will learn if they spend $10 on day one, they don't have anything for the rest of the week. Mm-hmm. And they'll learn those lessons at an age when mistakes don't really matter. Doesn't matter if you spend it all on day one, but if you took, you know, if you did that in life and spent all your salary on day one, you'd have a lot of trouble for the rest of the month. So you need to learn those lessons at a young age, not when you're like 16 or 17. That's too late. You need to practice those behaviors.
Yes. Can we, we're running out of time.
I'm sorry.
Just a couple of little questions. I think people are very much wired by dramatic experiences. And I'll just give you an example. The first time I invested, I lost. Mm. And so that wired me to have negative expectations. Now, on the other side of the coin, someone who goes to a gambling casino when they're a teenager, and let's say they win the first time they gamble, that wires them to expect to win, you know. Yeah. And I got wired to expect to lose. Like, we have a lot of different influences, but that was just, you know, when I was already in my 30s, but it was, you know, my first investment, and we lost. So I'm just interested in how you see people shaped by dramatic experiences and how you would suggest that they rewire them.
Well, as you know, you build your neural pathways through lots of little experiences or traumatic experiences. The danger with winning the first time you try something is you don't know whether you were right or whether you were lucky. And in my experience, and I've spent a lot of time in trading rooms, that always ends badly. So what you need to do is examine your decision-making process and ask yourself whether the process was correct, not the outcome. So if you And what's key here is that, so if you've invested money and it went badly, it may not have been, obviously in retrospect, it's a bad decision and it's traumatic. I can certainly understand that. But the question is, was the thought process around the investment flawed? Mm. Or was it just bad luck? So, yes. You know, yeah. Is it internal or external? Because if you can, you can still be lucky. At a gambling table, you can still, you know, put it on black and it comes up black. But, yeah. But fundamentally, that is a luck-driven process.
Yeah, it's my idea of the flawed process is whatever's trendy. Like you hear something, and yeah. Then already millions of other people have already done it. So right. How would you get information that was not trendy?
Well, yeah. So there is it's a behavioral issue in the sense that we like to buy things when everyone else is buying them, mm-hmm. and so essentially that is not a good investment strategy. Mm-hmm. If you want to step back and go, what is a reasonable investment strategy? A reasonable investment strategy is essentially dollar cost averaging, and you start that in your 20s and you keep going with it. Yeah. That is a reasonable time to invest. So you don't put everything in on red or black. If you want to think of it in a slightly at a bigger level, basically you always need to leave yourself room. So if you are going to put $50,000 and you only have $50,000 you're going to put in the stock market, either you need to make sure that you're doing this over a period of time to enable you to buy the lot. You know, because stock markets don't go up straight away, or you need to make sure that if the market dropped 50%, you don't need any of that $50,000 and you've got time to wait for the market to recover.
Yes. So let's just, last question. Let's just say a person has trouble saving. So what behaviors, what would you tell them to do, practical steps?
Right. So trouble saving is normally driven by an inability to understand your finances. And it's all at the practical level. So there's always two parts to it. There's the practical level, which is I don't know how to save because I don't know understand my finances. But it's normally underlying that is an emotional issue, which is why am I not saving? So what is blocking you from saving emotionally and what is blocking you from saving practically? So the practical aspect is, you know, if you want to go on Google, how do I save? You'll get 50,000 hits mm-hmm. on that. Mm-hmm. So it's never really the practical aspect to it.
Right.
What is emotionally blocking me from looking through my finances and working out what I spend and then what I can afford to save and how to divert that into some really modest savings plan? So I do this with a lot of my clients have trouble saving, and so we break it down. We start with what are your finances look like? How much do you spend on a month? Do you know where it goes? And how much is left over? Or is there any left over? And then once you get down to the here is a month's worth of spending, and are we making conscious choices around this? Did you realize that you were spending $50 a week on Subway? Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. As long as it's a conscious choice, then you know, and okay. You can afford it, it's okay. So I try to bring consciousness to people's decision-making process around money and show them how they can get control of it.
I'm always interested in the status aspect, the serotonin aspect, and that one-up feeling. So I have an interesting example. I love to travel, and a lot of people think they can't afford to travel, but I travel really cheap. And everybody I know, like, they want to stay in a fancy hotel. And I just don't get it, because like I don't end up going to the hotel until it's nighttime, and then I leave in the morning. And like, you know, the difference between a fancy hotel and another. I mean, it could be like hundreds of dollars a night difference. So I always, whenever I stay in an inexpensive hotel, I mean, not so inexpensive that I can't sleep, but inexpensive so that I don't feel like I'm a princess, because I feel like I get the rest of my life to get that. You're not going to buy that feeling. I'm not going to waste money on that feeling. I'd rather have two nights in a hotel and two trips rather than one night in a fancy place and have the illusion of being statusy, I guess. So, and I have a funny early experience to tie that to, I think. When I was a kid, my father would get free trips from his employer sometimes. And I got to stay in hotels that were, you know, for the time, they were very statusy, let's say. You know, today they wouldn't be. So that was like a huge deal to me. Sure. We didn't have much money. And yet, I would go to these hotels with my family, and then my parents would bicker. And then I sort of realized, well, you're the same person when you're in this fancy hotel or not. It doesn't change anything.
Right. So, yeah. And then sometimes there's the imposter feeling as well. It's like, I don't necessarily belong here.
Oh, so yeah. Think, yeah. It's another one. Know, well, that will help a person save money, right? Yeah. Yeah. No, in my case, I just want to make the trip twice as long.
Sure. And you want, so for you, your well-being is associated with the longevity of the trip rather than, you know, the status of staying in the XYZ hotel.
Yeah.
And you'd rather have a 4-week holiday or 2-week holiday rather than a 1-week holiday. And you know, that. And so the key to this, and it's a very individual thing, is, you know, what gives me the most pleasure and how do I align my spending with that? That is what financial well-being is in some senses, is how do I take what I have to give me the most pleasure?
Yes. Good. Yeah. Great. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And where can people find out more about you and what you do?
So thank you, Loretta. They can find me at www.moneycoaching.uk. And I'd also like to say that...
.uk.co?
No, it's just .uk, moneycoaching.uk.
Oh, okay.
Or you can, I think if you go to moneycoaching.com, it directs you there.
Okay.
And I'd also like to say that a lot of the stuff we talked about today comes from Deborah Price at the Money Coaching Institute in California. So she is, if you want to go local rather than in the same time zone rather than the UK time zone, then go and see the Money Coaching Institute.
Okay, but you have a very nice website that I highly recommend that's available in all times of day. So I like checking it out, and I like, he has a pyramid about financial well-being to understand. Well, the peak of the pyramid is wealth, and the base of the pyramid is neurobiology, and the emotions then come next, and then the behaviors. So I think that's brilliant. So very good.
Thank you.
Well, it's been so nice talking to you. Any last words?
Well, I just want to thank you, Loretta, for the chance to talk to you and for your wonderful work, because it certainly helped me understand my brain and helps me in my work with clients.
That's great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And my new book is coming out in a few months. It's called Status Games, Why We Play and How to Stop. So that will hopefully be relevant to your clients.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
It was great to have you with us today. We hope you'll keep learning about your inner mammal and keep checking out the resources of innermammalinstitute.org. We have books, videos, blogs, and graphics that will help you build power over your mammal brain. Help us spread the word by reviewing and subscribing to our podcast and checking out our books and videos. And do join us live on Sundays so you can ask your questions about rewiring your happy brain chemicals. Details at innermammalinstitute.org/podcast.